It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Tonight, let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
Thunder Stock here on Declare Your Independence with me, Ernest Hancock, each and every day from the beautiful studios of Freedoms with an S, freedomsphoenix.com here in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, we have Pam Perry in. We're going to go ahead and keep her, we'll go ahead and keep her for the next half hour. I got a whole bunch of other stuff building up I got to do in the rest of it. We'll have her stay over a little bit. She's agreed to stay over a little bit because I got a bunch more questions to ask. And I know she wanted to finish up on some stuff, and I got to finish up on some stuff. And the stuff she wants to finish up on, tomatoes. Tell you all about tomatoes.
Okay, tell you more about tomatoes. Well, if you have only got room for one tomato, you can grow him in a container. You can grow them upside down. There's some new interesting hanging things.
Yeah, we did that. That was convenient. It's easy to pick them. But the ones that they made, the sun just rotted them and they fell apart. It lasted like 2 seasons. I'm going, screw that, man.
Yep. Phoenix is different, ain't it? We other places don't have quite the intensity. I understand. But they will... You can get after them if you're worried about them setting fruit with a paintbrush and a little bit of blossom set. I tend to just go through. They're self-pollinating, so I kind of wiggle mine as I go through and pull my weeds and visit and make sure there's nothing crawling around like tomato hornworms. And I have been lucky, I think. I've had pretty good production out of my tomato plants. But I do know that here in Phoenix, we're watching the sort of the hiatus of tomatoes happen. If you haven't got a nice, happy tomato plant, you can go get a young one from the nursery. Look for a short season, cool tolerant tomato. And that sounds contradictory for Phoenix, but I'll explain. Anyway, you plant him in the ground and you just baby him along and make sure he gets watered and fertilized properly. And come fall here in Phoenix, when it's October and our temperatures are again in that wonderful window where the nighttime temperatures are finally down to around 55 and the daytime temperatures are not triple digits anymore. Hallelujah. My little new tomato plant will start setting some fresh fruit for me. And if I cover him in maybe November around Thanksgiving, when we often will get a frost here, he'll continue to make fruit as long as I cover him when the frost warnings go up. And then about Christmas, between Christmas and New Year's, if I'm going to start some tomato seed on my own, that's when I start my little tomatoes in by seed and have them ready to plant again as little, fresh, young, tender plants in February. Our frost date here.
That's Arizona.
That's Arizona. So if you're in Vermont, you're doing this in June.
Yeah, I know.
And if you're doing this in Colorado, you're probably doing it in May. And I don't know what you'd be doing in Texas.
You brought up something that was, before I forget, I want to mention. You're talking about tomato hornworms and so on like that. This one thing that we did not do anything when it came to insects or pests or eaten of the whatever.
Good.
We just let it go.
Good. You can share.
Yeah, exactly.
You can share.
Let me tell you the two things that I noticed. One, you got more birds coming in eating the insects, so we had more birds. You had different kinds. You get like ladybugs and so on.
And they're the good guys. Yeah, you really do want them.
So they would come in. And after it starts getting the equilibrium, there's a kind of a balance there. Because when you got a bunch of insects, you've got a bunch of birds.
Going, and you've got a bunch of good insects and a bunch of not such welcome insects, too.
So If I see some big eating whatever, you know, I just pick it off and chuck it over the fence in the alley or something. You know,
or feed it to the chickens.
Yeah. You
know, ooh, feed those hornworms to the chickens.
That was another thing. I know. you let the chickens in there, man, they just go at it, but they pulled up all my radishes, little snots, you know, because they don't really eat the roots or the radish. They eat the leaves.
Yeah, and they go after the green stuff.
So I'm going, you know, and they scratch and dig holes and lay eggs and stuff. So I'm going, wouldn't be prudent at this juncture. So putting them in our square foot gardening, we got them up higher, and then they still fly up there, and they just be pains in the butt. But, you know, so I got my own little farm, my little bitty backyard, you know. Well, my little granddaughter, she's growing up thinking, you know, middle of the feet, she's going to grow up thinking we lived on a farm or something. You know, she doesn't know any different. So
an urban farm.
Yeah, but when you're a little kid, a little backyard, you go see it later when you're 15 or something, or a picture, you go, wow, man, that was small. I thought it was huge. So the one point that I wanted to make is that you have all these insects and so on, you kind of let it go, you're really only losing, I would say, maybe 20%. I mean, you know, 50, you're getting some loss here, but there's an equilibrium. You'll have the more that they're getting, the more there are, the more you have the predators come in to get them. Mm-hmm. So I never, it's just watching this, one, because I was lazy, and two, because if I'm growing my own organic kind of, I don't want to be putting crap on it. That's the whole reason why I did it.
Now, the whole idea of going organic is to get rid of those very noxious pesticides, which don't do us any good either.
Yeah, but your cooperative extension's talking about the pesticides they approve. Tax dollars at work.
And the next thing you'll see there is something called integrated pest management.
Yeah, how about just not having
And the first rule of thumb on IPM is to first identify the bug. Too many people go off and kill something. Now, you're far more laissez-faire, much more live and let live. But some people see any bug, a bug, some bug, and they immediately panic. And so before you do anything about bugs, you better identify your bug. And then after you figure out who he is, then you can determine whether he's a good guy, a bad guy, or maybe just a guy who's hanging out because he needs a place to live. And most of the insects in our world are neutral. They do us no harm. They do us no foul. They're just living their lives as bugs.
And this is one of the benefits of technology like the internet. All this information is, they just look at bugs, put in kind of, I live at about and looks kind of like and has this many legs and this color and kind of, boom, there he is.
There he is.
And you go, okay, cool. So we have a lot going for us that technology and information, just access to information, has made our whole life totally different. So now I'm looking at it. I'm like, you know, I'm just one because I'm lazy, but I'm going to pay attention. So we had a full-fledged going. It was probably about, you know, no more than 15, 20 feet by 30 feet garden, you know. And if you go planting a bunch, and then a couple of little strips
that
we had.
That's a big garden.
That's
a big garden.
No, it was work. So, you know, we're going at it, and I'm the guy on the weekends pulling the grass out and everything because you got to, you know.
You got to weed.
Yeah, weed and grass. Well, I had to grass more than I had to weed. But anyway, so I'm going in there, and I'm watching this stuff, and you're seeing what's healthy, what's not. Yes, I could see that some insects were getting to some stuff. And it really was much less than I anticipated. If you leave it alone, you're okay. The problem is that in our commercialization of food and this kind of stuff, like you're saying, it's all about appearance. You don't want to have it. But when I was a kid, I remember, you know, that's why you washed your vegetables, because there was always bugs in it, you know. And it was just kind of, you're going in there, you're rinsing out, and you're washing, kind of, you're getting dirt and so on. I mean, it was fresh. I lived in Florida, you know.
It was fresh.
There was all kinds of stuff coming in there. And but then it's just marketing. It's like, no, it's got to be perfect. It's got to be, you're not trimming off anything. It's apples. Heck, we were always, as kids.
Oh, yeah, you work around the worm.
Yeah.
What's worse than finding a worm in an apple?
A half a worm.
Yeah, exactly.
So we were rotating it as kids. We're looking at worm there, cutting it slight. We'd eat by slicing the apple. It was a totally different culture. We were more integrated with what we were eating. Now it was all this, you know, plastic. You take the plastic fruit in the lobby at the hotel and, you know, put it in your refrigerator from the grocery store. You can't tell the difference. You know, so
exactly.
It's also education on our part to kind of, you know, look for something different. I have a friend of mine, he loves milk, but but he's just so sick of all the hormones and the pasteurization and the homogenizing, blah, 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 and all that. So he always gets goat's milk from a local guy that...
With goats.
You know, yeah, with goats. You know, I'm just... So I'm like, hey, mama, give me some goats, you know? So this is, you know, these are the things that we think about. It's not something that I'm doing because I, you know, want to, you know, lay on the ground and give Mother Earth a big, giant hug. I want to be able to live better. I want to be healthier. I want to have better tasting food. And one of those things is, as a somebody that's a, you know, works with sauces a lot, you know, and I have a restaurant and I'm experimenting with a lot of things. Man, I had a love affair with basil. What gives you the kind of Italian taste and everything is a lot of times is oregano or rosemary or something like that. But basil, I found I could use a lot less salt and sugar and a lot of other stuff the more I did basil, but it's expensive.
Until you start growing your
until
own.
Until you start growing your own.
Absolutely. They got you short by their short hairs in the market, don't they?
Oh, man, I'm a basil-growing SOB now. So I go in and I put it, and I started, you know, finding out, you know, I tell you where I first got my first attempt at growing basil, is you get those chia plants. And they had the herb chia thing. So I got it one time. It was 10 bucks or something. I don't know. It was nothing. And you started, I'm going, oh, my goodness. I'm a green thumb kind of guy. So this is something that we can all do. We can supplement our health, our life. Eat better. It tastes better. It's funner. It is good education for children and your friends and for yourself. We're going to talk about more we can do to, you know, integrate our lives into just being healthier by getting away from the man.
It's time for Declare Your Independence with Ernest Hancock.
There's a man going around taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down. When the man comes around.
Oh, and I know when he's coming. Man, the roosters had to go, okay? So here in Arizona, you want to keep the man away from you. You can have chickens, but I think the way in the city of Phoenix, this is how it's explained to me. Yes, you can have chickens in your backyard, but they have to be at least 80 feet from another dwelling or something, or have the permission of the people that you're next to. So what we did is we put it in one corner of our yard because one of the other guys that we knew, he just complained because that's what he does. And so what we did is we put it over there, and then she's a young attorney that lives. She don't care. Give me some eggs, you know, whatever. So that's kind of how we got around that. But they do allow for chickens to be in the city of Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how do you got them? You have chickens, right?
I've had chickens.
So what's your preferred way of housing them?
Well, it's expedient to keep them safe and cool because they get too hot in the summer to do a chicken coop and provide them a little shady sheltered spot, sort of a laying area where they can get into. We have found, even though you wouldn't think it, but we get coyotes here in Central Phoenix. My friend who lives out by the golf course not only gets coyotes, she gets hawks. And they really did a number on her chickens. So you really want a roof as well as four walls for your chickens. And fairly secure. You don't want anything sort of haphazard and flimsy because coyotes can be pretty determined. So can local dogs if they get loose and are too curious.
The biggest concern I had was, especially when they were young, were, you know, feral cats.
Yep.
And so they get a little bigger. We got some, what do they call them, New Jersey Giants or something. They'll kick your butt, man. They're big enough. You know, oh, yeah, I'll take you on.
Take me, yeah.
And then we have a little toy poodle, you know. And so he's out there. He's black. You can't even tell the difference between him and the chickens, you know. But the he's out there, and the cats come around. He's like, ooh, I was using my chickens to lure you in, you know. So there's a kind of this kind of symbiotic relationship with my plants and chickens and dog, and you know, we're good for us living in Central Phoenix. It's amazing what you can do with just a little bitty bit of land and just, you know, kind of a little education. The one thing that I wanted to make sure that you
got across to the people. You do this or promote this for what reason? I mean, is it for health? Is it for sustenance? Is it because you like it? Is it for entertainment? Is it for, you know, being able to survive the apocalypse? I mean, you know, your focus on this information that you have in your head benefits you and everybody else mostly because of what?
I grew up gardening. We lived far, far away from a lot of, it was northern New England in the 50s. I mean, you know, transportation was different then. The big roads hadn't come through. If you wanted it on the table, you better grow it, because that was where it came from. And we were out in rural Vermont. I grew up spoiled rotten. Vegetables were only good when they were fresh picked. I'll never forget moving out on my own and approaching my first vegetable counter at a supermarket and looking at the stuff and going, oh my God, the stuff is all 3 days old. It belongs in compost. And having to figure out how I was ever going to eat vegetables again until I could get my own garden. And I garden because I am a spoiled brat and I like my vegetables fresh. And I like knowing that I have chosen the fertilizers and I have applied them in amounts appropriate to the season and to the product. I don't think we need to over-fertilize I think we need to be able to provide, like you were talking about, growing without using huge amounts of pesticides. I can pick off a tomato worm here and there and feed it to the local birds. It's just fine. I think we've gotten too far away from eating seasonally. I like vegetables by the season, and when spring comes and the lettuce gets better, it's okay. I've eaten lettuce all winter. I will eat something else. I can happily eat eggplants and tomatoes and basils and the summer foods.
Arizona summer foods.
Arizona,
okay.
Summer foods.
She's talking totally. This is not applying to most of the audience.
All right.
Here.
And most of the audience is getting all of this all at once, and they just, it's a surfeit of riches for them. And we have to kind of gauge our riches and spread them out.
Well, you know,
the year.
One thing here in Arizona, is because we do have such a long growing season, you can go certainly early on Saturday morning. It's like half the parks around here have some farmer market
yes,
thing going on.
Yes, isn't it great?
You know, it's just, and we have different places you can go, and even you go out to the farms and the outside of town. See, a lot of people, you don't know how agricultural Phoenix really is. They don't know. I mean, we have in East Valley, we go to the peach farm out there when they're ready for harvest. They let the, I don't know, whoever go in and get first pick or something. I don't know how it works, but when they're ready to go, they just set up a little cash register by the fence there, and you go in, get whatever, and you pay for how many bushels you bring out.
Exactly.
And the thing is, we get in there, and we do this every time. We go in, ooh, that's a perfect one. Ooh, that's a perfect one. Ooh, that's perfect. They got ladders out there.
Yeah.
Ooh, that was so yummy. And I knew that. By the time you get done, you got 4 or 5 baskets full, and you only needed one. So what we do is we go in and get it. It's not real expensive. You either can them, or you come back, and they're only good for like a day.
About 10 minutes, yeah.
You know. I mean, they are
melt in your mouth. Oh fresh picked peaches. Nothing like the stuff that, you know, it's a whole different variety of peach that they grow for picking fresh than they do necessarily for shipping.
Really?
Yeah.
These are big. They're like melt in your mouth.
Tender. They wouldn't go on a trailer truck or a rain car across the country. Exactly.
They wouldn't make it.
Yeah.
You got to pick it by hand. You place it down.
But you can find this all around the country. It's called sustainable agriculture. And there are, whether it's urban areas, there's even sustainable agriculture in New York City. So it is something you can find in any town, more towns. California was probably one of the leading states in this. Many years ago, they started the whole farmers market and brought it back town by town to really support the local growers, that nothing has to always be. And yes, it's convenient to go to the market. And yes, we'll always need to get.
But there's always the man that shows up with his badge, and you can and can't, and do you got, and you need to. And I'm like, you know, do you pay sales tax on that? Do you?
On which?
I don't know. Whatever you're selling stuff and you're at the market, kind of, oh, I'm sorry. Because this happened. You know, they have what they call First Fridays over
exactly.
here.
Exactly.
You know? So people would do that.
Oh, yeah.
And they would be off to the side on it, and here comes the man with the badge. Did you get the blah, 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 blah? Yep, done. Gone.
Yep.
You know, the man, smack them upside the head. I'm just, oh, don't even get me going. Anyway, so you go to the peach farm. I get this stuff, and I go around and give them to my neighbors, mm-hmm. you know, or my friends. We went peach picking.
Yeah.
Or we make, you know, a weekend out of it, because there's a limited time that you can do this, like in a couple of weeks. I mean, it's fast.
Yeah,
it's not a big, long, you know, a couple of weekends there. And you get that, and every year, it's just, they're so delicioso. But then we have a lot of the farm. Another thing a lot of people don't know, here in the valley, we have a lot of flowers and a lot of gardens and farms and so on down by South Mountain, south of Phoenix out here on the other side of the river, which is only about now less than 10 miles from where we're sitting now. What happened during World War II, it was an internment camp for Japanese. Japanese came. I think they even had some camps for German POWs or something at the time.
Papago Park.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they had up against a mountain there, and the Japanese started, you know, creating flower farms. So now you have an industry. It used to be, you know, a lot of Oriental Japanese families. You don't see that much anymore, but that's where all these flower farms and stuff came from here in Phoenix. And these agricultural, you have all these big developments that you're talking about, you hear about here in Arizona, were farms. And they're just, you know, plowing them under, and they got onions
building houses on perfectly arable, productive farmland.
Yeah, and what they should be doing is building them up on the mountains that are just freaking rocks. Oh, no, can't do that.
It's so hard to get the services up there, though.
So what? Let them pay for it. I don't care. That's another government man saying what I can't do. Because the developer wants you to, you know, no, we got to build on the farmland. Don't get me going. It's all government's fault. It's the man every time I turn around. Well, thanks for coming on, Pam. We had a good time.
Okay.
And I'm sure we'll use you as a resource in the future, because this is a lot of good information that we all need. I know a lot of this kind of, you know, Arizona. But for all y'all, I know you can grow some stuff there, too. We'll be right back with a whole bunch of other news I got for you when we come back in just a little bit.
Roads? It's the Ernest Hancock Show. Where we're going, there aren't any roads.
I want to break free. I want to break free. I want to break free from your lies. You're so self-satisfied, I don't need you. I've got to break free. God knows. God knows I want to break free.
Yeah. Free. How do I do that? I want to do that with, keep breathing in and out. And one of the best ways to do that is just be healthy and I eat real food. So that was very nice, Pam Perry, to come in. Pam is, she's our graphics guy that does a lot of our graphics and printing, does her newsletter, you know, neighborhood newsletter that they do, and communicates with, you know, a lot of this kind of stuff and that she talks about. And he goes, you know, you really should talk. I do the news, you know, she'd be interesting. You know, I think, you're doing a lot of gardening and so on. Talk to Pam. So I said, yeah, you know, tell her come on down. So Sierra, producer, hooked that up, had her come in. Another resource. Maybe we differ a little bit on proper roll up, but you know, hey, you know, I can breathe in and out by sustaining myself with good food. So that'll be up there, and she'll promote that to her friends and what we're talking about. And I feel good about bringing this kind of stuff to you, mainly because it benefits me. Because I want the information. Might as well make use of it in a radio program, get it in an archive, and share what I learned with it. Because you can see, I didn't know. You know, good information. Today I wanted to, there's a lot of things that I want to bring up. And one thing I got to just get off my plate here. Here we go. I got an email Friday afternoon. I did a just kind of went mostly on, you know, gun rights here in Arizona and the advocacy of and different things that we had done and all this. And I got people thinking. And, outdoing me. They're coming out and going, oh, Ernie, you little compromiser. Well, let's go ahead and talk about it, because this is a good point to bring up, and I want to get this out of the way. And it's a good point, and I like this. I remember this happened before. We had, in 1994, we had John Buttrick is a judge right now, and he's a Superior Court judge here, and he ran for governor at the time as a libertarian, hardcore, no compromise. At the time, the whole thing was Arizona state constitution requires that you pay for public education. They just put it in the constitution, and you know, free or nearly free education. Well, of course, they're taking your money to do it. Well, we put, as a step towards getting the government totally out of education, you know, making the parents the administrators by them spending the money and have a voucher for the kids and everything, that would be a step in the right direction. Mark Victor, my friend and partner in the Freedom Summit, he's like, oh, you compromising pieces of crap. Did you would even say that? You deserve to be slapped. And we're smiling and everything, and I'm like, aha, what he said. So we're, you know, we go, yep, see? You know, you can't even, you know, Ben, even though the state constitution requires it, you're shouldn't be advocating in any way, shape, or form that you're giving money, you know, taking money from someone, redistributing it. It's just, it's bad, okay? Well, this, you know, maybe not exactly the same, but it's kind of in the same area. This is what happened. I'm talking about the lawsuit that we did. I went up against the Arizona state government, and it's a long story why, but it's about, you know, firearms and whether the law required that the state check them when you went to do business at the government. We were going to the Arizona Department of Revenue. My wife would pay our taxes from a restaurant there. And they, you know, after 9/11, they started doing metal detectors, and they're saying she had to check, and then they wouldn't let her check, and they got so finally we went, you know, through this process to get standing to file suit that they weren't by abandon their own law and that kind of deal. It goes to the Supreme Court, and the argument that, and I put it up there, all the case law that we used and the history and all this, that we made this information available because there were some guys that were working with us that said, we need to have information available to attorneys that would be able to defend people that were harmed or, you know, go against these businesses that said, you can't carry a firearm on our premises. All right, fine, it's their business, you know, that's cool. Then you would have roving gangs that were going around malls during a certain season, during the holiday seasons and so on, and you know, the lights would be out, or they'd go out and they'd be, you know, raped, murdered, and robbed, and whatever. But they were disarmed because the policy was you can't even bring it in your car here, or you gotta leave it in your car, so they are the mall owner held to a higher standard of liability for making it unsafe. Well, you kind of use an example is like, all right, should they be held to a higher, some kind of responsibility for having ice on the sidewalk? Say you're in Wisconsin or something. They have ice on the sidewalk. They don't even put a sign up that says caution ice. They don't put salt out. You fall, you're on your own. If you wanted to make sure you didn't, you bring ice shoes with spikes and just, it's your problem. Buyer beware, caveat emptor. All right. So the argument that they were using is they wanted to use civil pressure because it was always the malls and so on say, we have to disarm them because and have policy they can't wear guns because they had taught the corporate lawyers that by not having that policy, if there was a gun act or anything without saying there could be no guns, they would be held to a higher standard of liability because they allowed guns if there was ever any gun injury on their property because they didn't have a policy against it. Just lawyer stuff, okay? So counter to that, them saying, oh, no, you got to have a policy, a corporate policy of not allowing guns. If you don't do that, then you're going to be held responsible for when people do have an accident with a gun or even a crime with a gun or anything gun. So to counter that mentality, there were people that were saying that we did a lot of this research. It really had nothing to do with that. But we had all this research that was also on, you know, people are safer, they're this. You know, you have greater instances of problems when you don't have guns. There was an issue that we had in there where we had rest stops that they had signs, even though the law didn't say this. You could, you know, carry your firearm with you, get out of your car, go to the bathroom at 11 o'clock at night, and you're a young, pretty woman, need to go to the bathroom with your panties around your ankles, and you got a firearm with you. It's for when the guy, you know, comes in, old Bubba, with a rope or a gun or a knife and saying, you're mine, and he's right, except when you got a gun. So they would have signs on the park, you know, the rules or something of the rest stop, leave gun in car, you know, Really? Well, the law didn't say that. So we would have, you know, take your gun to the rest stop day. We'd have barbecues and make the media would come, make a big deal. Go ahead, arrest us. You know, we know what the law says. You're lying to people. The research was that all the crimes and problems that you would have were because people were disarmed. Anytime anybody was able to fend off somebody, or it was because they had a firearm. A lot of, you know, through deterrence or demise, as Barry Hess says, or something like that. You know, he called me last night. You're saying it wrong. But anyway, it's something like that. Through deterrence or demise, you know, you have a, you know, the problem takes care of itself. Well, what happened was, is that that argument was is so powerful, and there's so much evidence for people that even by just brandishing it or having it stops a lot of crime without ever even firing a shot. So the argument to the attorneys for the corporations and the malls and the, you know, and the big companies and the big box people and all that kind of stuff was, if you think that you're going to be able to get away with making this argument that somehow you're safer by disarming people, you know what? What if you have a bunch of civil litigation against you that they got harmed because you had that policy, because you didn't have them able to arm themselves, because you, you know, good argument, good PR, they can have fun with that. I'm not necessarily an advocate of there. I'm more with Scott. Scott sent me an email, look, man, you know, I was thinking you were doing okay until you started this, you know, they held to a higher responsibility and so on. And so it's, I can't remember what I was saying on the radio, but I was bringing this up, that this was a tactic that they were using, using the research that we had had in our lawsuit. It had nothing really to do with that. It was more about just getting all the information out there and are forcing them to enact their own laws. But it went something like this. I go, maybe I wasn't clear. If a place of business doesn't disclose a known hazard, make attempts to minimize the hazard, or allow you to negotiate the hazard, then they can be held responsible for your harm. Whether I think they should or not, that's not the point. They can. I mean, they do that all the time. You know, there's a soda spilled in the grocery store aisle or something. Oops, I slipped, I fell, you know, give me money. Example, ice on the sidewalk in front of their business. Caution, ice on sidewalk. Or they put salt on the ice, or they at least do not prevent you from wearing ice shoes in the winter when you go shopping. While I lean heavily towards your position of caveat emptor, you know, buyer beware, I was supportive of making the research available to use when there were signs like, there's no ice here, when there was long records of recorded violence at locations, etc. In a functional justice system, the difference would be determined by a jury. But the way things are now, I'm more likely to support the position of always assume that there is ice and don't shop where they ban ice shoes, you know, like Safe Map, Second Amendment for Everyone merchant awareness program, where we'd have anybody that have any kind of restrictions on guns, we go, fine, you know, cool. And we just put, mark their thing on the web, we send, you know, them a little card we give them, perforation, tear off, go enter them on the computer, don't shop there. And I invited them to call in. Well, then he had a response to that. When we come back, we'll go ahead and talk about the response that he had. Yeah, you know, I like it when I got an audience a lot more hardcore. You know, that's good. You guys are thinking. So this is, you know, I'm wow. You know, so he caught me. But I'm more on his side than he probably thinks. But we'll talk about it more when we come back. Then I got some more big news for you. All those kinds of stuff we're going to do in the last hour. We'll be right back here on Declare Your Independence.
And now, live from the studios of Freedom's Phoenix, Ernest Hancock.
Turn that dial all the way. Shoot me like a rocket in the space. Loving every minute of it. Loving every minute of it. Loving every minute of it. Come on!
Yes! Turn that dial! Shoot me into space! We're going to be talking about all the space race in the next hour. There's all kinds of good stuff going on. But first, I want to finish up on what we were talking about. You know, got a listener taking me to task. That's good. That's good. That's good. I like that better much. And, you know, this is, and I'm going to read what Scott had to say. He goes, no, you were very clear on it. I just disagree. It is the same argument that the liberals use for all of the crap they get voted in to protect the children legislation. Hold responsible? Nope. Boycott? Maybe. Besides, if a place of business doesn't disclose a known hazard, as I recall, the known hazard in your broadcast, I may be wrong here, was some dirtbag accosting someone in the parking lot or in the theater or some such. How the heck is that a known hazard? By that metric, and the point that we were making is that you have a an unsafe environment. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people. We've had this before here, where there were people after people after people that were being mugged and robbed and so on during holiday season. It was a, well, I don't want to say the name of the business, but it was, you know, out there. So they were using that as an example, making, you know, look, still your policy is that these people, you know, one after another, they can't arm themselves. I mean, you know, at what point does that become, you know, like, a bad thing? And it was a good PR deal that we had with, but I understand his point. He's making a good point here. By that metric, anything that goes wrong can be blamed on hold responsible, the business owner, which is sort of where we are right now. Business owners are expected to be omniscient. That's why I have a serious problem with the position you took. My bleeding heart liberal no law is too restrictive sister uses the same logic. I would suggest that warnings and such are beneficial. Holding one person legally responsible for the acts of another, that's just crazy. Dems my thoughts. Yeah, it's hard to argue with that. You know, I would say purely libertarian world, man, you know, that's your responsibility to know what's going on wherever you go. My point was, is that, you know, it's like, you know, they're saying, no, it's all safe, wonderful, come here, step into my parlor, when it's not. You know, is that fraud? You know, it's all about force or fraud. You know, there's no ice here. We're ice-free sidewalk. Boom, slip, fall, break neck. You know, are they held responsible? So where do you do that? One, you have to have a system in order to even do that. If I had to, you know, give up my potential and desire for a totally free society, and I got to, you know, risk, you know, looking around for ice patches, absolutely, man, I'm all over it. Get rid of it. I don't even need a government. Just, I'll never shop there anymore. And somebody does have a problem, they let it know, especially with the information technology that's out now, like the Merchant Awareness Program. You know, you can know where to go. You feel safer. You make these kinds of decisions. The free market will always find a solution. So I'm going to side with Scott on this one. Yep. But, it's kind of the compromise. I wouldn't even say it's a compromise. Well, I guess some people would say. I get a lot of flack on both sides because I run for office oftentimes. I'm not even sure. I got I think a day or two to decide. Yeah, by tomorrow, I got to decide if I'm going to go ahead and run for office here in Arizona. And I just can't muster up enough give a crap this time. I'm just, you know, we'll see. Maybe, I don't know. I'm really leaning against it. And it'll be the first time that I haven't been involved in election cycle since 1990. Now, I stopped voting in 2002, but I always saw the value in running for office. You know, it's kind of, they go, well, isn't that a little hypocritical? Hey, man, I'm not voting. I'm letting everybody know. You're still voting? I mean, but I'll take advantage of the opportunity to do whatever. Well, I got other methods now. I mean, we have Freedom Phoenix, got the internet, we have the radio show, we can put up signs everywhere anyway, we're still expressing our opinion, we got billboards, we do all that. So I'm like, that was the only reason why we did it to begin with, because there wasn't the internet. We didn't have the ability to express ourselves. We would use opportunities like this. You have a business, a mall, or something that you have people that were getting hurt on a regular basis with a policy that they couldn't defend themselves. So what did we do? Merchant Awareness Program. We go, look, hey, man, don't shop there. Go over there. But there were some people that were saying, look, they're using the government to give them limited liability as a corporation so they can't be held responsible, and they're harming people by making it where they can't protect themselves. Then they're saying that, you know, these lawyers and so on and judges and jury, all this, they're giving them the impression that they're creating a safer environment by making guns banned when, in fact, they're making it less safe. Do we educate them by using this information and say, you know, we're going to hold you responsible because you made them less safe? I understood the concept. I understood the idea. They were getting limited government monopoly protection against any kind of responsibility for making it unsafe. You have to create a culture that people understand, oh, you're really causing more harm with this. By having a no-gun policy, you are held to a higher responsibility for people getting hurt. I understood the logic. I understood the concept. I never really got on board with it. I was more about just the merchant awareness, saying, hey, don't shop there, go over here. I was with Scott on this one. But I understood the power of making that kind of argument. The problem is that then you're starting to bring in, you know, government. You're starting to bring in the court system. You're starting to bring in, you know, like they're going to have some kind of mechanism by which they're going to protect you and make it work or something in one way, and you're twisting the system, and I'm not. I was just trying to explain how this, you know, you can, you know, see how they can make use of this. You just turn their argument against them. But in the end, what are you doing? You're advocating for the system, that there even be a system. I get it. Scott, you win. All right, so let's go on to something else. One thing that I wanted to do is that I wanted to make sure that I had an opportunity to give you a perspective on things, something that I keep hammering on this show, because it's so important to me that we know if we are allowed to dissent. Are we allowed to complain? Are we allowed to leave? Are we? The one thing I wanted to bring up, and we have it on Freedom's Phoenix today, and it caught my attention, it got me in the morning show, I just started going off on it, was that there is an anniversary today, a birthday, that we should all be aware of. Today is the fourth anniversary, 4 years, of the first private space station that's been in orbit for 4 years. Oh, and by the way, it's 130 miles higher than International Space Station. And another thing. A year later, they sent a second space station. They've been like tens of thousands of orbits. and there's so many ands here. It's just, you know, it's freaking amazing. So there's this is, you never hear about this. Why? What they had is a plan for a third test bed to go up. It's been so successful that they go, well, you know, we don't even need to do it. The third one is, what the heck, man? We'll just go ahead and send up, you know, the main station that we've been developing, and it's called BA-330. So that's Bigelow Aerospace 330. I'm not sure what the 330 is. I think it's, something to do with the space of it, you know, how much living space it has. So what they've done is because of this has been, let me give you the history of expandable spacecraft. Now, this is, you know, your 1950s, they're, you know, the space race starting. How can we get the most, you know, volume of something up there and it, you know, be light and we can send it up and we got to come up with something, right? So the concept of utilizing expandable or inflatable spacecraft, you know, it's not new. The history of inflatable space systems, you know, goes back to the very beginning of America's space program. You know, as a matter of fact, it was the inflatable Echo 1 and Echo 2 that were the first, you know, passive communication satellites. You know, they, you know, just put in something in space and be able to communicate with it and look, we did it. All right. These were part of the original projects back in 1958 by a new federal agency called NASA. Now, it had the diameter of a 10-story building. It was huge. It had all kinds. You could put all kinds of stuff in there. And it was very pretty, you know. It's a UFO. It's a UFO. Weather balloon. Yeah, that's all it was. The challenge that the first NASA engineers faced was how to put such a large structure into space. And they had this small Thor Delta rocket, you know, and it couldn't lift like big giant. They didn't have Saturn V's back then. So they needed something to get it. So they came up with the idea of an inflatable system. Well, the problem was, you know, they came up with this new substance they called Mylar. You know, Mylar, that's like, ooh, this is good of the day. Well, it's still, you know, an amazing material. So even as early as the early 60s, the use of inflatables was, you know, not just limited to communication satellites. You know, they had successes with the Echo, and Langley Research Center wanted to apply the advantages of this inflatable large volume, you know, that was light in weight, you know, that can fit in a small rocket and go up. But they just kind of, you know, that was too easy, too cheap. And a lot of times you had, you know, different types of materials that they needed they didn't have, because you didn't know what kind of radiation, what kind of light, what kind of UV protection did you need, what kind of protection did you need from the occupants, what kind of micro meteorite, you know, impacts it could take. Could it be self-sealing? I mean, there's just all kinds of stuff that goes into it. And then he had the invention in the 90s of Kevlar, you know, and all kinds of stuff. All of a sudden, now all these new materials are ready. They're getting ready to launch. In 2014, they're launching, and they're leasing space right now. They're buying space on Falcon 9, which is an orbiting platform that now they can put stuff into space. We're going to space. They're going to space right now. And government's not invited. But they're going to try and invite themselves anyway. We'll talk about it. I keep telling you guys this is coming. Here we go. We'll have more when we come back here on Declare Your Independence in just a little bit.